It's the time of year when we're all thinking about goals and priorities. Now is the time to plan your next trip. Whatever kind of travel fills you up, whether it's lounging on the beach, connecting with family and friends, or going on a foreign adventure, Expedia has the tools you need to plan a great trip. Download the Expedia app or visit Expedia.com to start planning. You do need to be a One Key member to use price tracking. Signing up is easy and free. Expedia, made to travel. We've all been there. You have a question about your credit card, you call the number for help, and can't get a hold of anyone. If you only had a Discover card. With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right, a real person. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I'm Oprah Winfrey. Welcome to Super Soul Conversations, the podcast. I believe that one of the most valuable gifts you can give yourself is time. Taking time to be more fully present. Your journey to become more inspired and connected to the deeper world around us starts right now. Today on Super Soul Conversations, Sheryl Sandberg, the COO of Facebook, the social media leader with nearly 2 billion users around the world. 4 years ago, it was Sheryl who coined the phrase "lean in" when she called on working women to step up in their careers and shatter glass ceilings at the workplace. Now Sheryl is on a new mission that's landed her on the cover of Time magazine once again. After suffering the loss of her beloved husband, Dave Goldberg, she's helping others find their way through grief. Sheryl Sandberg says her husband, Dave Goldberg, was her best friend. The pair married in 2004 and later had 2 children. 2 years ago, Dave died suddenly while on vacation in Mexico. In her new book, Option B, co-authored with psychologist Adam Grant, Sheryl shares her moving account of the sudden death of her husband and all the life-affirming lessons she learned on her journey back to gratitude, resilience, and joy.
So I won't ask you, how are you doing? Because from reading Option B, I learned that that is an inappropriate question to ask somebody who's gone through a horrendous experience. So I will ask you, how are you doing today? It's now two years since Dave died, yeah.
I'm different.
You're different.
I'm a different person. I'm sadder. I have this grief and sadness in my life, and it's like right here, I can touch it, and it kind of, it comes up on the obvious days, the Mother's Days, the Father's Days, our anniversary. I am also more grateful, more present, more alive. I mean, I think being here with you would have been a special day at any point in my life, mm-hmm. but even on moments like this, I am more aware of just how precious it all is and how short.
So it woke you up.
Yeah, I didn't,
in a way that you hadn't been awakened before.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I hadn't thought of it that way, but that's exactly right. It woke me up. Mm.
In the beginning of your beautiful book describing what the process of grief is really like, you talk about it sometimes showing up like a wave. Do the waves still come?
They do. I mean, I had read about grief. Everyone's read about grief. Mm-hmm. But experiencing it is a different thing. It felt like, it was a void. It was closing in on me, so I couldn't breathe. My brother-in-law talked about it as a boot covering his chest. My friend Kim, who lost her brother, he died by suicide, thought of it as a fog covering her everywhere she went. And in those early days and weeks and months, I thought it would never get better, ever. It just didn't feel like it would ever get better. I would ever catch my breath again. And part of the reason I wrote this book is people told me it would get better, but I did not believe them. And it has. I sit here today still with more sadness, but with a lot more gratitude and more cognizant of joy. I am awakened, woken up. And I want people to know that the fog does lift. It comes back. But like the early time when it will not lift even for a second, that changes.
And so often when somebody has gone through a great loss, we just don't know what to say. And so what happens is you end up saying nothing. You end up doing nothing because you don't want to remind the person of their grief. And yet you say something so, it really struck me, like, there's nothing anybody can say that's gonna cause you to, like, remember that you've lost your loved one. There's nothing anybody can say. It's always there.
Correct, and it's always there for other people too. You can't remind me I lost Dave. You also can't remind someone that she has cancer, or that his father just went to jail, or that she lost a job. It's not possible. Big hardships, these challenges, they're always with us, but we often don't say anything. And I understand this because I always did it. If someone in my life were going through something hard, usually the first time I saw them, I would say, I'm so sorry.
Right.
Very little.
Yeah.
And then I would never bring it up again because I didn't want to remind them.
And you would also say, how are you?
How are you?
How are you?
I mean, how are you? Ready? How are you? Not great.
Not great.
No one says that.
Yes. And also, when you say not great, if you say not great, nobody knows what to do with that.
Correct.
They're like, oh God, I knew I shouldn't have brought it up.
Correct.
You know, as though me asking the question or asking the question caused you to be not great.
And I think it's about acknowledging pain, because when we don't say anything, the person still knows whatever they're going through, but they feel alone. And that's what happened to me. You know, before Dave died, I would drop my kids off at school and everyone would say hi, walk into work. Facebook's a friendly place. Everyone would chit chat. After Dave died, it was almost like I was a ghost. People looked so afraid to say the wrong thing that
so they would avoid it.
Yeah, and they would walk into the meeting and sit down and wait for me to start the meeting. They wouldn't even talk to each other.
Yes. And I found it interesting that you felt, you know, with the big elephant in the room, how odd that people would see you and not even bring it up.
I would have dinner with a good friend, they would come over 2 weeks later and be like, how are you? How was work today? Like, how was work today?
Yeah.
Well. And so what I've realized, and I saw myself in this, I didn't acknowledge before, is there is something so powerful about acknowledging. Not everyone wants to talk all the time, but you can always say to someone, I know you're hurting, and I am here. We can talk about it, we cannot talk about it, but I know you are in pain.
Yeah, or I know you've been through that. I know, even if you don't know what it is, because people feel like they've got to say, oh, I can imagine what it is. You really can't unless you've been through it.
No, you can't.
No. No.
Okay.
So last year you spoke publicly for the first time since Dave's death during your commencement address at UC Berkeley. And I think these were the lines that caused that speech to go viral. You said, Dave's death changed me in very profound ways. I learned about the depths of sadness and the brutality of loss, which that word struck me, the brutality of loss. But I also learned that when life sucks you under, you can kick against the bottom, break the surface, and breathe again. So how are you learning to breathe again?
I'm learning to let the grief come when it comes.
Mm.
It was very good advice. My rabbi told me to lean into the suck.
Lean into the suck.
Not what I meant when I said
yes,
lean
you,
in.
You miss lean in. You miss lean in for our times. Lean into the suck.
Which was actually really good advice, because I think for me and a lot of people, when we get upset, we're kind of upset, we're upset. I get sad, and then I'm sad, I'm sad.
Yeah, that's called secondary.
I call it the second derivative, right.
Yeah, secondary.
I get angry, and then I'm angry, I'm angry.
Mm-hmm.
I get nervous, then I'm nervous. And so it just piles on. And when he just told me, lean into the suck, this is going to suck, it really helped me be like, settle into the feelings. And then they kind of, they were more gentle, or they passed more quickly. And my friend Davis, who's a filmmaker, told me this. He looked at me and he said, when I do a film, he does documentaries.
Yeah, Davis Guggenheim.
Yeah, I don't know where it's gonna go. The story has to unfold. And he said to me, you cannot put your grief in a little box. You are trying to tie it up with a bow and understand it and analyze it and structure it. No, this is your story and you have to let it unfold. And that means you need to just let it happen.
So learning to lean into the suck was a process for you. And actually it was your friend Phil Deutsch who said, tell me about that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a few weeks after Dave died, and there was a father-son activity we had signed my son up for, and so we needed to do something. So Phil helped me come up with a few ideas, mm-hmm. someone who could cover for Dave, and it was good. And then I said, but I want Dave. Dave's supposed to go to this with our son. This isn't how it's supposed to be. And he said, option A is not available, so let's just kick the out of option B.
Mm.
And it was we were going to kick the out of option B. He didn't say you're going to. His arm was around me and he said we. And when he was traveling and not with me, he would write me one line emails, you are not alone.
Mm.
A childhood friend sent me a card that still hangs above my desk that said, one day she woke up and realized we were all in this together. My friend Elise, this is the acknowledgement. Rather than not saying anything because you're going to remind them, say something and say we. We will get through this. I don't know what's going to happen. I know you don't know what's going to happen. Acknowledge.
Yeah.
But we, I will be there for you.
Yeah. And, you know, what I've discovered is everybody just wants to know that they matter. And that acknowledgement lets a person know in the fullest sense of themselves that not only do I matter, but the fact that you see me and you as a part of the we, it's and that's an amazing gift to give.
The other thing I learned was the power of just doing something specific. Mm-hmm. So before Dave died, if someone was having a hard time, I would say, is there anything I can do?
Yeah.
And I meant that kindly. Mm-hmm. But when people ask me that question,
now you gotta figure out what it is they need to do.
Right. Yeah. And the answers that pop into my mind are not doable. Well, can you make sure my kids and I are never alone for a holiday?
Yeah.
Can you make Father's Day disappear along with the father-daughter dance so I don't have to live through them?
Yeah.
You know?
But so many people showed up for you.
Macy's Mother's Day gift guide has the perfect gift to make mom feel special. Shop by price, like 25 and under to 100 and under. Category, like fragrance, handbags, and more. Or gift lists, like for the mom who has everything. Gifts that are already wrapped and ready to be gifted and for grandma. Get top gifts like Dolce & Gabbana Devotion Eau de Parfum, Coach Floral Printed Leather Cassie Crossbody Bag, and Le Creuset Shallot Dutch Oven. Shop at Macy's.com/giftfinder.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere. This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
So you called Adam Grant. I know you and Adam wrote this book together. You called Adam Grant and said what? Help me?
Yeah, he came to the funeral. We had been writing together. We wrote a New York Times series on women in the workplace. And, you know, he was a psychologist. And I was so terrified that I didn't know how to get my kids through it. Mm-hmm. I was worried their childhood happiness would have been eradicated. You know,
because your biggest fear was?
My kids wouldn't be happy. I mean, it's as a mother, you have your
of
own
course.
Pain, but the pain of your children. And I also, you feel like you're supposed to give your kids a safe, happy childhood. Every mother wants that. Not everyone can, because we don't help them enough, but every mother wants that. And I couldn't protect them from this. And I asked him, what do I do? Tell me what to do to get through this and get my kids through it. Mm. And those are the conversations that eventually led to writing this.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me the most when I read Option B was the fact that you found Dave, you and friends found him on the gym floor, and the memory of him being on the floor and where his face was placed and you trying to give him CPR and then someone else trying to give CPR taking over for you and then the medics coming in, that you're finding him sort of place that trauma in your brain in a way that had you not found him or just heard about it and he'd been taken to the hospital, wouldn't have.
Yeah, I've only had this experience.
Yes.
I mean, it's all horrific no matter what happens, but we were at Phil's party and it was time to go to dinner and Dave wasn't around and, you know, I didn't really worry about it. He's 47 years old, but when he didn't show up for dinner and he'd been gone a few hours, all of a sudden I was like, oh my God, something's wrong. And my brother and sister-in-law and I ran to the gym and we found him. And I tried to do CPR. Doctor came, ambulance, the whole thing. And it's just one horrific moment after another. Just, you know, and the whole time through it, again, it almost feels like a dream or a nightmare and you're praying you're gonna wake up and, you know, people have asked me what was the worst moment. There's just a lot of competition for that slot, but probably telling my children.
Yeah.
By far.
And yet, in the telling of your children, I want to talk about how do you tell your children. You walk into the house, That same day? It was that same day, right?
The next morning.
Or the next morning. You walk into the house, and your daughter's going up the stairs, and she doesn't notice, but your son sees you and immediately notices something's wrong.
Yeah, well, you know, she's 7, he's 10, so mm-hmm. I'm not supposed to be home till the next day. Mm-hmm. And she's like, hi, Mom, and goes upstairs. But he's 10, he's like, why are you home and where's Dad? I had a family friend, Carol Geithner, who counsels grieving children, mm-hmm. and someone reminded me to call her before I got home, which was great. And she really helped prepare me, and I mean, so I tried to follow her advice. I sat down on the couch with my sister and my mom and dad and my kids. You know, I said, I have terrible news, which is, you know, basically the understatement of all time. Mm-hmm. And I just tried to tell them. And what Carol said to emphasize over and over was that they weren't going to be alone, that they were surrounded by love and friends and family. She also prepared me, and thank God she did, because I would not have been prepared for this, that they would ask right away if I was going to die too. Mm. Which they did. It's a very common reaction children have to the death of one parent or someone close in their life. And I would have just never known how to handle that.
And yet there was a miracle in that moment, which is the reason I'm asking. I just find it miraculous that your 10-year-old son, in that moment of you telling him the most horrible thing he could ever hear in his life, he says, I'm so glad you came home to tell me.
He said,
me.
Thank you.
I said,
Mommy, thank you for telling me yourself.
I find that amazing.
And then that night when I was putting my daughter to bed,
yeah.
she said, I don't only feel bad for us, I feel bad for Grandma Paula and Uncle Rob too, because
yeah.
they lost him. And so at the worst moments of their lives, my kids are able to have gratitude and empathy. And
yeah, I think
that gave me hope. It really did.
Yeah. When I read that, I think I thought that speaks to the kind of children you and Dave had raised. I mean, to have a child in the worst moment say, thank you, Mom, for coming home and telling me yourself. And to say, I feel bad, but I'm also thinking about my gran and other people who loved him, too.
And my kids have...
Well done, may I say. Well done.
It's them. They get the credit. You know, they have perspective other kids don't have. My son's basketball team lost the playoffs. And all the other little boys were sad if he were crying. And I looked at him, I said, are you okay? And he looks at me and goes, Mom, this is sixth grade basketball. I'm fine.
Really?
With a tone of, Mom, they don't know. They don't know.
But he did say to you at another point when you were, I don't know, wavering or you were trying to decide what to do. And your son says to you, Mom, just be yourself.
I had to go to his school musical thing, and someone said, I asked a woman how she was, and she said she wasn't doing well because her husband was out of town and missing the performance. She didn't mean it, but it just flooded me of,
yeah.
Dave will never be at another one again. And I just went home, and I was kept it together while I was there, but as soon as I got to my house, I was just crying. And once a year, I have Facebook's biggest clients over for dinner, once a year. And they were downstairs, and I just couldn't stop crying. And my son came up and said, Mom, everyone's here, you have to go downstairs. And I couldn't stop crying. And I said, well, I can't stop crying. And he just looked at me and said, Mom, they all know what happened to us. You should just go downstairs and be yourself. And then he said, turns around, and he goes, I bet they have things they cry about too. And I think my kids had to learn. And for a 10-year-old boy and a 7-year-old girl, that's not easy, that respect our feelings, like the feelings were going to come. Like he had times he couldn't stop crying.
Yeah.
And we all do.
Yeah, because you write about the primal wailing that happened when you first told them, and also when you all got out of the car to bury their father, how they just dropped to the ground and nobody could move, and then you dropped to the ground with them, and people were piling on top of you.
My cousins,
and everybody's
yeah.
hugging. I mean, that is...
Yeah, it was horrific. And there is one...
But it's also love. It's love showing
it's
up
love.
For you. Yeah, yeah.
And then I didn't know what to do. And everyone's kind of waiting for us to do the burial, and they're screaming, and my cousins. And I started singing, which I'm not a very good singer. But what's interesting is, and I've thought about this a lot
it's
since
It's what
then,
you sang, yeah.
I started singing this song called Osei Shalom, which is a song mm-hmm. from my childhood. And I didn't learn until way later that song comes from the Kaddish, which is the prayer we say when someone dies in Judaism.
Wow.
So I knew the Kaddish and I knew the song, but I don't remember ever being told that one was from the other. And I don't remember ever singing Osei Shalom before in my life. And I feel, I think that in that moment, the fact that that song came to me was someone trying to protect us or protect them. And I looked back on that as another sign of hope, along with my son thanking, my daughter having empathy. There's hope in even in those horrific moments. And that's what I want people to understand with option B. There's hope. There is almost always hope.
I love what you, when you wrote on page, actually 72 here, when I wrote Lean In, some people argued that I did not spend enough time writing about the difficulties women face when they don't have a partner. They were right.
They were absolutely right. I mean, in Lean In, I wrote about different family structures, but I also wrote a whole chapter called Make Your Partner a Real Partner. And, you know, that's like the father-daughter dance, the label. If the father-daughter dance were called the, like, daughter-friend dance or the daughter-pick-a-person dance, yeah, then people without fathers could pick
daughter-relative. Daughter-relative. Yeah.
Anything.
But it's called father-daughter.
So it explains to you that you don't have a father. That chapter said, make your partner a real partner, so it implied everyone had one. And I was wrong. And I wrote it for Mother's Day last year. I've thought so much about what happens to women who don't have partners or lose partners. You know, 37% of single mothers in our country of all backgrounds live in poverty. And the poverty line is low. People really struggle way above that line. It's 40% if you're Black or Latina.
So you didn't get it. You say you didn't get it. You obviously knew those facts. You had the stats.
But I didn't get it.
But you didn't get it. You say, I didn't get how hard it is to succeed at work when you are overwhelmed at home. I mean, that's a big statement.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know how hard it is to succeed at work when you're overwhelmed at home. And I think for every woman who, you know, is being asked to lean in, who is a single mom, who is overwhelmed, they're going to lean into what? I'm just trying to survive.
That's right.
Yeah.
And we need a lot of change. We need a living wage for people. Federal minimum wage hasn't been raised in forever. You know, we need child support. We need affordable child care, which we don't have in this country. We're the only developed country in the world with no paid maternity leave. One of the only ones with no family and medical
leave. And it's not getting better, it's getting worse.
Well, we have no choice but to make it better because where we are is completely unacceptable.
By the time I finished reading this, I thought, I don't know, Ms. Sandberg. Are there some political leanings? Do you think, how do you feel now, obviously, writing this book, having the conversations that you've had leading up to this book, including here, you're going to open the door of people being able to speak to one another, change the way we look at grieving in this country. But is there more?
I love my job, so I'm staying at Facebook, but I feel that I have, with the opportunities I have and the voice I'm able to have, I have a responsibility to argue for the public policies we need, to set the right example at Facebook, argue that other companies and help other companies follow, and to kick a lot of very ugly elephants out of a lot of very ugly rooms. I got an email yesterday from a very senior man running a very male kind of organization, and he said there's a woman who works for him who lost her husband suddenly, and he is trying to be like Mark Zuckerberg. And so when this happened before, he wouldn't have brought it up because he didn't want to upset anyone. But now he's been talking to her all the way through. And he shared with me a letter she so kindly wrote to him, saying to him, you're my Mark Zuckerberg.
Wow. Because Mark Zuckerberg was the Mark Zuckerberg of all times.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. I called him from the hospital, and I called him and said, yeah, I text him, really important. And he said later, I do that all the time, or I used to do that all the time. So he didn't think it was really important, but he called me right back, and then he was just shocked. And yeah, he helped plan the funeral. He showed up for me and my kids. And the most important thing he did is he built my self-confidence back up at work. I have no idea how he knew how to do this. I didn't know how to do this. Before, at work, if someone was going through something hard, I would do everything I could to take the pressure off. Do you need time off? You don't have to do that project. Of course you can't focus with all you're going through. And those are kind and important things to do. But when the person wants to be at work, when you say that, what happened to me is when people said that to me, I'm like, oh my God, I can't do my job. That's why they're telling me not to show up. Oh my God, they don't want me to do the project. Mm-hmm. And my self-confidence really crumbled even after Lean In. When Dave died, because I couldn't get through a meeting without crying. How could I contribute?
And you're sitting, and I think it's important to note, as you say often in the book, you're sitting in meetings and you're thinking about that gym floor.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I knew where I was.
Yeah.
But I would just see him.
Yeah.
And then I would cry. And I would think about telling my children and think about what was going to happen that night. Mm-hmm. But what Mark did is when I said, I came to work the first day, I was there for 4 hours. As far as I could tell, it was total disaster. I fell asleep in a meeting. I misidentified basic stuff. I rambled. It was bad. And so I called Mark that night. I said, maybe I tried to come back. It was 10 days later. Mm-hmm.
Maybe
the grief
it's too
experts.
Soon.
Yeah, the grief experts had told me to try to get my kids back to school and get mm-hmm. back to my routine. So I was trying to follow their advice. I said, maybe it's too soon. I made a total fool of myself. Mark said, lots of people sleep in meetings. But then he said, but I think you made a really important point today, and here's what it was. And then he said, come back or don't, up to you, when you're ready. But you helped us even today. It was the nicest thing anyone could have done. So now when someone's struggling with something personal, I always say, do you want time off? We have great policies. Do you want things taken off you? But I also will say the next day, the next week, hey, do you want to do this? Only if you want to, but you're still the best person for this.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere. This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
I thought this was so memorable and struck me when you were saying everybody knows about the Golden Rule, and you had lived by the Golden Rule for the longest of times. But through this process, you created the Platinum Rule, which is...
Well, the Golden Rule is do what you think want done to you. Yeah. And that's what I had done.
Yeah. Do the unto others, you have them do unto you.
Right.
We all know
Except
that one.
I was wrong about, like, not bringing it up, asking to do anything. I realized we don't know what people who are really going through something we've never experienced want. So the Platinum Rule is do what they want.
Mm-hmm.
So you can ask someone, you know, look, you're my very dear friend. I know you're going through this real hardship, and we work together. What's better for you? Every morning, should I say, how are you today?
Mm-hmm.
And acknowledge? Or would you rather I not say anything while you're at work?
Ask.
Ask them.
What a profound thing. Ask.
And then listen. And then really listen.
So with your children, before Dave died, there was, you had family rules, right?
We had a mission.
You had a mission. And your mission.
We didn't really have rules, although we had rules, but not. Before Dave died, we talked about our, you know, we had read Bruce Feiler's book, mm-hmm. and it had said, make a family mission. So we had done that with Dave, and I treasure that we have that. Dave signed it as well. It's up. And it was to make, you know, they were young. It was to be kind to everyone. That mm-hmm. was our family mission. But next to that, after Dave died, my kids and I wrote family rules. We wrote them together. So the first rule was respect our feelings. It's okay to be sad. They're gonna need to take cry breaks even from school. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to be jealous of other people who still have fathers. Even of me, I still have a father. And it's okay to be happy. The fact that I can sit here, I'm right here, right now with you, and I'm okay. I am not picturing Dave. I am not about to curl up on the floor. I'm walking without pain. Not every minute, not every day, but a lot. But I appreciate it. It never occurred to me to be grateful for a day where I didn't cry all day. Mm. Ever. Or even that I'm old.
Dur.
Yeah. On March 27th, somewhere around 5 or 6 p.m., I lived longer than Dave lived.
Mm-hmm.
And I was cognizant of that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, I wanted him to live, but the appreciation for, oh my God, you know, hopefully in August, you know, I will turn 48. Dave never turned 48. Never would have appreciated it before. No one can make a joke near me again about growing old. If anyone makes a joke like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm growing old,
yeah.
I literally look at them, I'm like, don't say that.
Yeah.
because we either grow old or we don't.
Yeah. And also, what you talk about so beautifully in option B is this getting through all the firsts. And you were keeping a journal, which I think is really, it's so therapeutic. I've kept journals since I was 15. But keeping a journal up until that Dave's birthday, which I think marked, what, 156 days?
Yeah, it marked 5 months, yeah.
5 months.
I had always wanted to journal. I have boxes of journals, starting in first grade.
Where you started and didn't
finish. January 1st, I don't think I got to January 10th a single year, but I restarted a new one, I was hopeful. But when Dave died, I just journaled. I sat at my computer for hours and wrote and wrote and wrote. And if I didn't write for 2 days, I felt like I was gonna burst.
So it was your way of letting it out, yeah. You also came to, I will say, the hard way, the understanding of how gratitude and looking at, because I've been doing this since the mid-90s, where you go through the day, and I have journals filled with just things that brought me joy and pleasure that I'm grateful
for. It's amazing.
Journals filled with it. And you make the point that I've tried to make to people for years, that when you are looking for three things or five things in the day that are going to make you joyful, you go through the world looking for the goodness that's going to show up.
Correct.
Correct.
So it turned out joy is a discipline. We have to work at it. And I probably didn't work at it hard enough before, but now I really
Or you took it for granted. You do what everybody does. You took it for granted.
But it's exactly that. Before this, I used to go to bed every night worrying about what I did wrong and what I was going to mess up the next day. And now I go to bed thinking of the positive, but also I notice them during the day. I say, that's going to make the journal. In that moment. And I take, and that
I
moment.
I love that.
Yeah, or maybe you do five, maybe five. 3 moments, 5 moments, write them down religiously.
A moment would do it. I mean, just because it is stopping and taking stock of where you are in your life. And it's also looking at the good stuff. And I will tell you, when you look for the good stuff, more good stuff shows up.
And we're not very good at understanding happiness as human beings.
Like, yeah.
I thought of happiness as the big stuff. It's not the big stuff. Joy is the small stuff. So those moments of joy do not need to be some big event, and they're usually not. My coffee tasted great. This tea is actually delicious. No, it is. This tea is delicious. One of my kids gave me a hug without being asked, maybe hinted at, but not outright asked, right? These tiny little moments are the moments that make our lives.
And I'm telling you, Cheryl, when you go back and look at what you've written since 2016, I mean, it will bring you joy just to read the joy journal.
Well, yes. Then the joy builds on the joy.
And then the joy builds on the joy. It's the secondary.
Second derivative.
That's
right.
You were talking about. So in all these ways, you're not the same Cheryl that you were before Dave died. Yeah.
No. I am more present. I am more cognizant of the joy, and I am so much more grateful for life.
Mm. And you know, there's that moment when I think it was your brother-in-law? Was it Rob who came in and said to you, "I think it's time."
So important. Mm-hmm. No, so important. I told my kids early on that they should respect their feelings and be happy, but I couldn't give that to myself. About 4 months after Dave died, I was at a friend's bar mitzvah kid, and a high school friend pulled me onto the dance floor, and we danced. And then I just kind of collapsed. I mean, crying. It was embarrassing. I had to be kind of taken outside, and I didn't know what was wrong. And then I realized it wasn't that I was sad. I was happy. And the guilt just flooded into my body. What am I doing on a dance floor when Dave is gone? How is this possible? And Rob, my brother-in-law, called me right around then, and crying on the phone, it was the most generous thing anyone could have done. He said, "All Dave ever wanted was for you and your children to be happy. Don't take that away from him in death."
Wow.
And what I want option B to do, and what Adam and I are hoping, is that we will show up for each other, kick elephants out of the room, get people through the acute grief, mm-hmm. but also give them permission for joy, for laughter.
And did you feel in the beginning that you couldn't joke about it? That, oh my gosh, you couldn't make a joke about it?
I would joke about it, and then I would be horrified. I mean, I said to my sister-in-law, "Well, at least I don't have to watch Dave's bad TV anymore." Mm-hmm. And I laughed for a second, and then I just gasped. But one of the things I want option B to give people permission to do is make the jokes, because the jokes help us. I now understand there are a lot of jokes told at funerals.
Yeah.
There always have been, but I never thought about why. Because it gives us a moment, a second, to have joy and to feel like it's going to be okay.
Well, I think what is so wonderful, I think what Option B does, it not only gives you permission to take the joy back, it gives you permission to grieve in whatever way is suitable for you. And you did that with your kids, with a game that you all played. Yeah.
Taking things back. So what we used to play, Settlers of Catan, it was our family favorite family game, and Dave and I were playing on our iPads when he died. So at first, one of the reasons I wasn't joyful, and Adam pointed this out, he's like, you don't do anything fun. Anything fun reminds you of Dave, so of course you have no joy. Of course that moment on the dance floor was your first moment of joy 4 months later. You've systematically cut...
Thank God for Adam, my gosh. Right,
no,
yes.
Absolutely. But you've systematically cut all joy out of your life because it reminds you of Dave. And so I decided we were going to take things back. So we took back Settlers of Catan. Without making a big deal, I said to my kids, who wants to play Catan? They're like, we do. Took the set out, putting the pieces out. My daughter reached for gray. And my son said, Daddy's gray. Daddy was always gray. You can't be gray. And I remember putting my hand on them and saying, yes, she can. We take it back. If she wants to be gray, we take it back. We take it back in Daddy's name and Daddy's honor. And we took things back. Dave was a Vikings fan. We cheer for the Vikings. Dave was a Warriors fan. We cheer for the Warriors. I took back Scrabble. I used to play with Dave, and Dave used to play with his brother. And now I play with Rob on my phone a couple times a day. Again, these tiny, well, there are more moments of joy for him because he's always winning.
Yeah.
But it's joy for me, too. His profile picture is him and Dave. So I have these couple moments a day where I play Scrabble like I used to do with Dave with my brother-in-law, and I see his face. Mm.
You also gave yourself permission to date again. Mm-hmm. And I found it so interesting, the stats on women widows versus male widows who date. Like 54% of men, I read in option B, 2 years later are married.
1 year later are dating.
1 year later are dating.
And 7% of women.
Yeah,
I mean, we...
And why is that? Because...
We judge women much more harshly for dating than men, and that's why men date sooner and more often. And I'm really lucky because the people who gave me permission were Dave's mom and brother. They were the first people to mention dating to me. And I think it's because they had lost Dave's father, so they had that experience. But we don't want women particularly, but people to move on. And for me, the thing is, I never wanted to date again. I knew who I wanted to spend my life with, but option A is gone. And so the permission I got from my closest friends and family, even though I did get some public criticism, really mattered. And I want option B to give people that permission. One way you can help others is you can say to someone, it's okay to date if you want to. I am there to support you. I know that this isn't the choice you would have wanted to make, and I'm not going to judge you. Let me help you find someone. Yeah. Or make a joke. I'm here to cry with you. I'm here to show up in the hospital even before being asked. And I'm here to laugh with you. I mean, one of the most profound lessons of this whole thing is that this is not just a story about grief and loss. This is a love story. You love after someone dies. I love Dave every bit as much as I ever did. And I do. I'm dating someone. I have joy. I have sorrow. But death does not end a relationship, and death does not end love.
What's the hardest choice you've had to make to fulfill your destiny?
I think getting divorced. I was married once before Dave. I was young. Mm-hmm. When he and I decided to, you know, not be married, I was 25. Mm. Felt like this huge failure, but I was too young. And he was a wonderful guy, so it was a hard decision for both of us to make, but it opened me up to where I think I needed to go.
What's the lessons taken you the longest to learn?
Gratitude. Dave had to die for me to find the gratitude. You know, I've asked a lot of people who's heard of post-traumatic stress. Mm-hmm. Everyone says yes. Who's heard of post-traumatic growth? No one. But more people experience post-traumatic growth than post-traumatic stress. After trauma, we grow. We get more joyful in some ways. We get more appreciative. And for me, it was gratitude.
Yeah. If you allow it to, though, don't you think you have to be open to it? Because there are a lot of people who shut down and they never move forward.
I think you have to be open to it, and you have to know it's possible. It's why Adam and I wrote the book. Adam told me post-traumatic growth happens. You have to believe. And I think, and Adam thinks, we think pre-traumatic growth happens. You can grow without the trauma.
That's right.
You can find that gratitude without the trauma.
Oh, I know you can, because I listened to so many stories over the years, and I would like, don't want to go through that. Let me get that lesson through you. Don't want to go through that. Let me get this. Yes. What's the best piece of advice you ever received and actually followed?
I think writing down 3 moments of joy. Mm. Best advice. Has changed my life.
What do you think is the biggest obstacle to peace in our world?
Understanding. Mm-hmm. Seeing ourselves in the other people who are suffering. Mm-hmm. Why do we let millions of children die of malaria and unclean water? Why is 1 in 3 children in the San Francisco Bay Area hungry tonight? Because we don't understand, we don't see their experience in our own. We don't see our experience in theirs.
You were able to find your path. We were just talking about how making the decision to divorce your first husband opened you up to a greater possibility in your life. How would you advise people who are looking to find the path forward for themselves?
Believe that option B exists. Mm. I mean, no one's life is perfect. We're all living some form of option B. But trying to realize that when you have no choice, which we often do, to focus on what we can still be grateful for. Realize you're walking without pain when you are.
So I love this where you write, resilience in love means finding strength from within that you can share with others. Finding a way to make love last through the highs and the lows. Finding your own way to love when life does not work out as planned. Finding the hope to love and laugh again when love is cruelly taken from you. And finding a way to hang on to love even when the person you love is gone.
I still love Dave. This book is about grief and overcoming loss, but this book is a love story to Dave Goldberg. And I hope it honors the life he led. Mm. You know, he was amazing. At his funeral, I've never seen this done at a funeral, our friend Xander in his eulogy asked everyone whose life was changed by Dave Goldberg.
Oh, and everybody raised their hands.
Hands went up. I meet people to this day mm-hmm. who say, not I knew Dave, because that's not surprising, but Dave changed my life and here's how. And so if option B helps anyone, hang on to love or recover, it's what Dave Goldberg would have done.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And thank you, Adam, for writing this book, because I think it gives everyone a new way of expressing what it means when you don't have option A, to be able to have an option B. You've given us permission to kick the shit out of option B.
Thank you.
I'm Oprah Winfrey, and you've been listening to Super Soul Conversations, the podcast. You can follow Super Soul on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join me next week for another Super Soul Conversation. Thank you for listening.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.